Do Chinese-made routers and cell phones pose some kind of national security threat? From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is Monday, the 8th of October. We're also going to talk about the re-election of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Winter is coming early in California, at least in the gas tank. And we will talk about where the sense of adventure has gone in investing. Our occasional conversation with Fortune Senior Editor-at-Large Alan Sloan.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The U.S. House Intelligence Committee says China's largest telecommunications companies should be banned from doing business here. The bipartisan report says Huawei Technologies and ZTE Corporation are too close to the Chinese government. Michigan Republican Mike Rogers is the chairman of the committee, and he discussed the report on CBS's 60 Minutes last night.
I would find another vendor. If you care about your intellectual property, if you care about your consumers' privacy, and you care about the national security of the United States of America.
For more on this, let's turn to John Sudworth. He's the BBC's correspondent in Shanghai. Good to talk with you.
You too, Jeff.
Tell me a little about Huawei. I mean, it's not really a household name here in the U.S.
It isn't, but it's already a huge deal here in China. It is, by some measures, the world's second biggest manufacturer of telecommunications components. It sells its parts and its products to the big Chinese telecoms companies. And in recent years, it's gaining ground in the U.S. One estimate I saw recently suggested it brought in a revenue of about $1.3 billion last year in the United States alone.
So this is an international economy we live in. People sell goods across state lines all the time. What's the potential risk that our House Intelligence Committee is highlighting here?
What's different this time, I think, is that this is a very serious allegation from an official source against two particular companies, against Huawei and ZTE, both of them very big players. And what appears to be the concern is this suggestion that the companies weren't able to satisfactorily prove distance from Beijing. They weren't able to convince the committee that they were clean from all influence from the powers that be here in China. And that appears to be at the root of this report, a real concern that US companies and the US government in particular ought to be careful and serious consider those security implications. Of course, that point of view already being very strongly denied by the companies themselves, who deny all allegations or suggestions that they are somehow stooges of the Chinese government.
John Sudworth is the BBC's correspondent in Shanghai. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Jeff.
Continuing our focus on China for a moment, Japan's car makers are reporting a huge drop in sales there, and it's not about China's slowing growth. Anti-Japan protests in China have become such an issue that Toyota and Nissan have both cut back on Chinese production. Here's Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
Purchasing habits are emotional, so emotional scenes like this resonate. A woman screams in anguish. Her husband has just been paralyzed by an attacker wielding a bicycle lock at an anti-Japanese protest in the city of Xi'an. His crime? He was driving a Toyota. The video of this attack spread like wildfire in China before the government took it down. But the message is clear for the Chinese. Buy Japanese cars at your own risk. So where will Chinese car consumers turn?
They're more than likely to turn their attention to American products, especially General Motors, but also Ford.
Michael Lasky is CEO of AVL China and an expert on Asia's auto industry.
This could also change if there was ever a dispute between America and China.
Lasky thinks falling sales for Japanese cars in China will be short-lived, and with President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney battling it out on who can be tougher on China, a potential spike in sales for U.S. car makers in China may be short-lived, too. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Well, a gloomy World Bank outlook for Asia is helping drive down U.S. markets this morning. Certainly not a lot of afterglow from Friday's pretty decent U.S. jobs report. The Dow Industrial Average, a couple hours into trading, is down about 0.33%. The S&P 500 down about 0.5%. And the NASDAQ, as is typical in these situations, down the most of all, verging on 0.8% at this hour. One of the country's largest health insurers, United Health, is buying the largest healthcare company in Brazil. Amil Participação, a little Portuguese lesson for me this morning, provides medical and dental coverage, but also runs hospitals and clinics across Brazil. Today, the Nobel Committee in Sweden begins giving out this year's prizes. The prize for medicine went out today. While it's, of course, a priceless honor, this year the committee has cut the monetary award by 20% to reflect the ongoing financial crisis in Europe. 2012 winners will get around $1.2 million. Chicken scratch, really, is what that is. Today is Columbus Day in the U.S. That means stock markets are open, bond markets, though, are closed, and banks are closed as well, so don't go to the bank. If it had not yet occurred to you that today is Columbus Day, that could be because, like me, you are at work. Rare is the workplace these days that still recognizes Columbus Day as a paid holiday. Marketplace's Mark Garrison, also hard at work today, reports on the business impact.
Getting Columbus Day off is a fading privilege eroded by tight budgets and controversy with Native Americans. Nearly half of states don't recognize Columbus Day as a paid holiday. Tennessee does, technically, but the day off is the Friday after Thanksgiving. So weekend guests at Blue Mountain Mist, a Smoky Mountains B&B, largely checked out yesterday. Manager Jason Ball wishes more could stay through today.
When you get the longer stays, like the 3 nights, that's pretty huge in any kind of accommodation.
Retailers count on Columbus Day, too.
Hurry! Discover the savings at Electronic Express before Columbus discovers this deal.
Leon Harris manages an Electronic Express outside Nashville, which is heavily promoting its Columbus Day sale. He expects good business today, but nothing like on a paid holiday.
I mean, people are off work, then you're going to have more foot traffic, more people walking around. Columbus Day is a little different.
A difference more businesses have to deal with. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Well, we talked on the podcast on Friday about the prospect that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez could lose this one. And in the end, it was close, but he did not. He prevailed. Hugo Chavez has been reelected to a new 6-year term. He had 54% of the vote, much closer, though, than what he's gotten used to during his 14 years in office. For more on the implications for the global economy of 6 more years of Chavez, potentially, I've got Frederico Barriga. He told me to roll the R, so I'm doing it. Frederico Barriga, a London-based analyst at the Economist Intelligence Unit. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, same here.
Do you think we can expect anything different from Hugo Chavez, given that, you know, he did have kind of a close call here?
Well, you would expect more or less the same as in the past 4 years in terms of economic policy. Yes, he had a close call. It was probably his hardest elections to date. But, you know, his margin of victory was big enough that there is no reason to think that he'll take a different stance, especially not a more conciliatory stance, for instance. On the other hand, there's a risk that he might radicalize even more his revolution now that he has another 6 years in power and controls pretty much all the organs of the state.
So that is certainly something for foreign companies who might wish to try to do business in Venezuela to keep in mind.
Yeah, certainly. Venezuela has one of the most difficult business environments already, so there's little he can do that can make it, you know, riskier. But it also has a very large potential in energy and mining. So it is a bit of a mixed outcome because Venezuela does need foreign investment in the energy sector in order to sort of boost production. But the business environment is definitely not going to improve in the next 6 years.
Venezuela does have the largest estimated oil reserves in the world. What are the implications for all of us energy users elsewhere in the hemisphere and on the planet from his approach to managing those?
Potentially, Venezuela could be producing, you know, much more than the 2.8 to 3 million barrels a day that they do now. And that could have an impact in oil supply. But at the moment, the majority of these reserves that you mentioned are located in the Orinoco Tar Belt, which is not the traditional area for oil production in Venezuela, which requires a lot more investment, and that hasn't been really forthcoming. There has been some investment, and they've been able to raise production a little bit, but there aren't any signs that they will be able to up these things in the next 6 years to a level that would have an incidence in global oil supply. But the potential is there. The Chinese, the Russians, even some American companies have eyed the reserves there, and there are some projects going ahead. But as I said, it'll take time, and under the present government, it'll be very gradual.
Frederico Barriga is a London-based analyst for the Economist Intelligence Unit. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, Venezuela's enormous oil reserves are certainly not doing a lot of good for the people of California. In California this morning, drivers are paying an average of $4.66 for a gallon of gas. And the state has passed Hawaii for the dubious honor of priciest place to drive. And so Governor Jerry Brown has ordered that winter will come early this year. The state will switch over early to so-called winter blend gasoline. To explain what that even means, let's turn to a California-based economist, Esmail Adibi. He's at Chapman University, not far from Los Angeles. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
So first of all, let's define this winter blend as opposed to, I guess, a summer blend. What is it exactly?
Exactly. What we have done in California during summer months, we use a special blend of gasoline, which is less pollutant. And we use that all the way to October 15. Then we switch to winter blend, which is mostly used across the country. And that more or less puts limit on the supply of gasoline that could come to California. Whenever we get into trouble during summer months, we can't import gasoline from anywhere else, and we are at the mercy of our refineries domestically. There's a refinery up north in Fremont, and that refinery got into fire a couple of months ago. And then 2 weeks ago, we have a refinery in Torrance, and they lost power, and they couldn't produce as much gasoline. So combination of those two factors basically reduce the supply of gasoline, and it's all about supply and demand.
Now, gas prices are typically on the high side in California, if only because of the taxes there. Where was this switching point where suddenly it becomes a real crisis and people start freaking out?
You're absolutely right. Gas prices are more expensive in California because reliance on certain refineries. And remember, adding those additives, it makes gasoline a little bit more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem this time was really external. So reduction in the supply led to really rapid increases in prices. Thankfully, though, the governor signed this order allowing usage of winter blend. That means that we can get gasoline from out of the state. However, having said this, the bad news for consumers is that we're not going to see any quick relief in price reduction, because very many dealerships are buying gasoline at high prices right now. They have it in the storage, and they want to recoup that cost. So they're not going to reduce the prices, even the supply goes back to normal.
Economist Esmail Adibi is at Chapman University in Orange, California. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Some new statistics sent to me this morning from the Investment Company Institute say that the percent of U.S. households owning stock is at one of its lowest points in the last couple decades. Basically, investors are getting cautious, even as stocks are having something of a banner year. The S&P 500, for example, is up about 16% on the year so far. Time for a little chat about the state of investing, I think, with our regular guest, Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. Hello, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So your next column jumps off from talking about an actively managed mutual fund that you've owned for many years. Let's remind people, what does that mean when we say something is actively managed?
It means the managers are going out and trying to pick individual stocks or individual securities and have a result better than the market. I picked the fund largely by accident, and the last time I looked, I had beat the market by 700% totally by accident.
Now, that sounds great, but it gets us to this question of sort of actively managed investing versus this sort of particular kind of caution that's been preached to people for years about index funds, which basically sort of track the market and are meant to be kind of a safer way of handling your money. What's the conventional wisdom you're sensing right now in terms of kind of adventurous investing versus something like index funds?
Well, I don't know what the conventional wisdom is, but I will tell you what to do, which I rarely do, which is if you don't know what you're doing and you don't have any fun at this and don't have anyone helping you, just buy an index fund, because on average, an index fund will do better than an average person will or an average mutual fund will. If you have money, you're willing to risk, and you have some idea of what you're doing, well, then maybe buy an active fund or buy individual stocks. But you have to know what you're doing.
Those of us who have investing memories of at least 10 years can remember when investing was supposed to be fun, and maybe it was too fun. Do you have any nostalgia for those days when people were doing a little bit more stock picking, or was that just frankly the bad writing was on the wall?
Well, in 1999 and 2000, I saw the handwriting on the wall, and everyone and his brother was out trading, and I knew that couldn't last. But now you have the opposite, because people have been scarred twice in the last 10 years by huge drops. And now the market goes up. People's first instinct is, gee, I'm ahead of the game. Why don't I get out? And that's fine with me if it makes people happy. I'm playing a different game, and I don't worry about the conventional wisdom. I worry about survival.
Alan Sloan, senior editor at large at Fortune. Thanks.
My pleasure, Jeff.
And finally, one more little international item before we wrap up here. Like us, Ukraine has a Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and an Eternal Flame nearby. Unlike in the U.S., in Ukraine, you can evidently walk right up to it. A 21-year-old woman has received a suspended prison sentence for frying eggs over the Eternal Flame. Now, the woman says she fully intended to get arrested as a protest against the poor economy. I don't know if they have this saying in the Ukraine, but for protesters there, I guess, you know, can't make an omelet without breaking a few. Anyway, I'm Jeff Horwich. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update podcast from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.